bath. He was fucking me. And he came, right? But I hadn't. So he just kept going.
Oh, shit.
Mm-hmm. Then he came a second time. Right when I did.
You're listening to the Still Queer as Folk podcast. Each week, we take down an episode of Showtime's Queer as Folk TV show to find out if it still holds up 17 years later. I'm Patrick Randall.
I'm Matt Dominguez.
This episode is called One Degree of Brian Kinney. It's number 12 in season 2 of Queer as Folk.
It first aired in the U.S. on April 7th, 2002.
It was directed by Tom Best. He also served as the director of photography for 43 episodes of Queer as Folk. A DP on a TV show is the technical guy that creates the look and feel of an episode according to what the director wants. Tom Best directed 3 episodes of the show as well. This is his first. He also directed 2 episodes of our favorite show, Degrassi, The Next Generation.
Fist pump for that. So DP does not stand for double penetration. Good to know.
And not in this context. Not we get to that later in the show or later tonight.
One Degree of Brian Kinney. I have to admit, after the wedding, I'm really glad we got to this episode. One Degree of Brian Kinney was written by showrunners Ron Cohen and Daniel Lippman, and the teleplay was written by Michael McLennan. He wrote the Pride episode.
Loved it.
Shout out to the Pride. And the Love for Sale episodes this season, and he writes 12 more episodes in the series.
Do you remember how much I was not looking forward to the Pride episode?
And you were like,
I loved it.
You brought yourself around.
That's
I didn't
right.
have to do any of the work.
Love that episode. Here's the synopsis of tonight's episode from thetvdb.com.
Still upset about finding the body in the dumpster and outraged by the apparent lack of progress, Debbie sets out to do some detective work on her own. She lives out her Cagney and Lacey fantasy because it's Sharon Gless. I love it. Her quest eventually pays off and she is able to notify the police of her findings.
Meanwhile, Michael is distraught to learn that Ben had slept with Brian 2 years back. They had a sleepover.
At the white party.
Yeah.
With ropes.
Tom Best had quite the intro to this episode. It's shower night at Babylon, apparently.
You would think it was Spin back in Chicago.
Oh, I used to love that so much. I miss those old shower contests.
Well, Charlie's in Chicago, I think, picked it up for a while, but I don't know who does it anymore or if they do it anymore. Maybe it was like a health code thing now.
For a while, the bar Roscoe's had the wet boxer contest where nice, hunky, cute boys and or twinks would put on like Roscoe issued boxers. So which means that they at some point they were naked there because they took off their own underwear and put on these.
Oh, absolutely.
And then they would kind of chub up a little and then they'd step on stage and a drag queen would pour a pitcher of cold water down their pants and then they would sort of dance.
Listeners, you can't see this, but I am rolling my eyes very hard right now.
I wonder if they still do that. We're going to have to look into this. So it seems like Tom Best has been keeping it all inside since episode 1 because this intro was a scorcher. It was hot.
You mean like temperature hot or you found it sexy?
Sexy. Okay. Sexy hot. Okay. It looked hot in Babylon too because everybody had to be hosed off.
Oh,
they were
yes.
taking showers. And
I was particularly a fan of Ben Bruckner being shirtless.
It's kind of funny because after a while, he just stops doing that. So far in every episode, I think he's been shirtless.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tom Best. So our A story here is Michael and Ben with a little bit of Brian sprinkled in. Brian immediately introduced a new element to the story with that sly little jab at Ben about being at the white party a couple years ago.
You're back. How was Miami? It rained every day. I never left the hotel.
So the white party was a big success.
Not as good as that one a couple years ago.
Yeah.
Well, you two were at the white party together? Along with half gay Pittsburgh.
Yeah, I was there doing research for a paper. The influence of tribal ritual on queer culture.
Yeah. More like the mating dance in the morning, homosexual.
Come on. Dance.
So this is Ben's 4th episode. When did he first come in?
That was back when Michael got the comic book store.
Right, because he had bought the comic book store and then Ben had to lure him out of the store to go to give that presentation. We yes. actually had an interesting discussion with some fans on our Facebook page about whether Ben Bruckner was being creepy or not. And one person actually agreed with me. It says, you know, in retrospect, I looked at it. And now that you mention it, okay, got it.
Hey, she was on my side for a while. So I'll take that as a win in my corner, too.
This leads me to my next point. Brian and Ben both waited this long to mention their two fucks that involved rope at a white party.
2 years ago, before Ben had ever met Michael. But you're right, in the sense that it would have been nice to have had that moment of, oh, I know how I know you, much like how Michael had his reaction during the dinner party at Dr. David Cameron's when he said, I know you, you gave me crabs.
Yeah. Well, of course, Ben was only at Babylon that night to research the influence of tribal rituals on queer culture.
No, that's why he was at the white party.
Ah, yeah, you're right.
That was his reasoning for being in Miami 2 years ago. At the same time, Brian so happened to be there.
Didn't he also research something at Babylon before, like tribal dance rituals where everybody danced until they dropped dead?
Well, no, he used the experience at Babylon to personify his belief, like the Buddhist belief that he had or something like that. It was during the first time that they had met.
I think they just needed to drop that line in there to remind us that Ben is a professor.
Professor Ben Bruckner.
We haven't seen him doing any professorial things lately.
Until later in this episode.
Did he do something professorial?
I thought he was like grading papers or something.
Was he?
I thought he was.
I'll put a star on this one. I'll put a little...
Good job. Needs improvement.
There was a great shot from Tom Best when Brian and Justin were in Babylon and they came up to the bar talking about Brian fucking Ben.
What? You fucked him, didn't you?
Who?
Who do you think? Ben?
Where'd you get that idea?
He's only like the hottest guy I've ever seen. How many times did you fuck him? I want numbers and positions.
Once. Twice.
I'm getting hard just thinking about it. How come you haven't told Michael?
It's the first rule of gay etiquette. Never talk about your past fucks. Especially if one of your past fucks is your best friend's current fuck.
It was a shot that I'd never seen before in the episode or in the series. Babylon became more scenery in the background, like living scenery with a bunch of hunky shirtless, mostly naked men dancing behind them and kind of a shallow depth of field. It was really nice. There was just something stylistic about it that I really keyed in on. And I like that shot there. So it's nice to have a DP directing the episode.
Oh, and I love that Justin knows right away.
Yeah, his clairvoyance.
And he's like, you fucked him, didn't you?
How uncanny.
And he finds it so hot to know that. And I think that's very telling. But, you know, that brings into like the greater point that I think we should discuss later on about what happens when you know that there is an overlap in lovers.
So, I've never heard that rule of gay etiquette before. And I don't know if I actually believe it or not.
I was surprised that Brian tried to tout out some rule about this.
Yeah, especially because he often talks about guys that he's fucked. They all do. So this new gay etiquette thing just sort of appeared out of nowhere. I just don't believe it. Like my close friends, we talk about everybody that we fuck.
Exactly. I never...
We were talking about that before we turned on the mics tonight.
It's true. I feel like Brian brought out this rule just to try and get Justin off his back in this one moment because he didn't want to, I'm not sure, screw something up for Michael or not flaunt it in any way, which is, again, something that's sort of an anathema to what we know of Brian.
He does have a fair number of tricks that he doesn't mention. Those pop up from time to time. We're left thinking, oh, I guess Brian fucked that guy. We did not know that.
At this point, we just kind of have to assume.
I just want to find out that Brian fucked Emmett. I think that would be delicious.
Of all people, yeah.
Yeah. There's a scene of Michael and Brian in the steam room talking about sex. I felt like that dialogue was something new also. They've talked about sex before, but this time it just seemed way too artificial. Almost as if McLennan was just building up like a hotness factor in preparation for the bombshell that's going to come up later.
It's the kinkiest thing you've ever done with a guy.
It's too weird to talk about.
Come on, dish.
Well, one night I went to this guy's house and I stayed over.
Very funny.
The next morning he made pancakes.
Ben and I did some pretty kinky stuff last night.
Like what? Flavored condoms?
Guess.
I haven't a clue.
He tied me up.
No shit.
Totally surrendered to him. It was so amazing. It's all about trust, you know?
Yeah, it's pretty good when you're the one doing the tying, too.
And the way he held me afterwards, I've never felt so close. Bet you don't find that kind of intimacy at the white party.
Yeah, I guess not.
All your one-night stands can't compare with what I got.
It's like,
Well.
It was a nice writing trick here, though, because the viewers know that Brian fucked Ben, but Michael doesn't know. Since we know what's going on, we're able to kind of go, oh, Michael.
It's called dramatic irony.
Yeah.
But I do love those shots they do as Michael is trying to show how he has the upper hand. We see how things went down 2 years ago in Miami. And yeah. It was nice to know that even the rope was white.
At first, I thought that that was Michael. And so I'm thinking, wait, why is Michael tying up Ben? Michael's like a big Nelly Bottom. And then I realized, wait a minute.
Point of
That's
clarification.
Brian and Ben.
Point of clarification, we do know that Michael is verse.
That's true. We found that out much later.
But yeah, to show the kink, because that's how the conversation started with, was Michael asking Brian, which I feel like this is such a loaded question, what's the kinky stuff you've gotten into?
Yeah, it's like...
Like, at first I would think, considering how long they've known each other, Michael would know the answer to that.
The only kinky thing that I think of when I think of Brian is that cop at the Comic-Con that he was banging in the police car with his baton.
Yeah. While wearing the hat and the... Yeah.
Have we seen Brian do anything even remotely more than vanilla?
We've seen him lust after leather folks, but that's about it.
Yeah.
We've never seen him actually engage in any type of kink play the way, say, Ted did.
Yeah. Ted became the suck pig.
Right. Speaking of, you know, at the time of this recording, it is the weekend before International Mr. Leather.
Yeah, yawn.
Many of our listeners will be disappointed to hear that, Patrick.
I've gone once. And the only thing that I found remotely amusing, well, there's two things, I guess. There was this box that one could step into. You'd strip off all your clothes and you'd step into this box and it would like vacuum pack you, kind of like a ham.
Yes.
Okay. I don't know what it's called. And so I've seen like tons of pictures of my friends in the vacuum packer. Do you know what I'm talking about? You're looking at me like, what?
Well, I think I'm trying to envision this contraption because I've only gone once. I remember going and really remembering two things. One, the live demonstration from there was a website, basically it was jocks, but they were tied up. And there was a live demonstration of tying someone up and play happening in the market. And the other one, I thought this was so fantastic. It was a guy who was working one of the booths and he was showing how sturdy a particular sling was. And so these were, you know, heftier men. So one was in the sling, the other said like, and these were, it was tied to like four posts. and he was literally selling this as he was doing it. I saw him use it to launch himself off like he was a gymnast, and he did a flip onto the guy who was in the sling to show how he could hold the weight. And I shit you not, he did a backflip off of him and stuck the dismount.
Golly.
There was applause all around. I was very impressed.
That puts the vacuum packer to shame.
I enjoy IML for those things.
The other thing about IML that cracked me up was the, I don't know what it's called, but all the pups are running around in the little pen.
Yes.
Shit cracks me up.
Yeah, actually, a couple of years ago, that was an outbreak of, I believe, strep or something like that, because obviously with pups, they're licking people's faces.
Really?
Yeah. Someone knew he had been diagnosed with something and still went anyway and thus infected a bunch of people.
All the pups got, I don't know. I don't know. I was going to say something that pups get, but
I don't know.
Like dogs, I don't know. Whooping cough?
Do they get strep? I don't know.
Speaking of licking, Here's a clip that Ted had.
Hey, Emma.
Nice to see you again.
You know him?
Yeah, very well.
Small world.
What, you did him too?
Mm-mm. No, but I went home with the luscious lips over there, who spent a night on Bald Mountain, who used to chow down on your love muffin.
Yeah, well, I did all three.
So this element just kind of built up the notion that everyone sleeps with each other. It was something, though, that we hadn't heard from these characters before. They never really got into the I had him first type of thing. It was always, oh, yeah, I slept with that guy. And the other person would just kind of riff off of that line. They wouldn't say, well, I did too.
Well, and this brings up the point of that there is going to be inevitably some kind of overlap. We are going to end up sleeping with some of the same people, or we are going to know some of the same people in the case, just because there are fewer of us. it's going to be what happens. And it's actually something that Dan Savage brings up in his show as well, that because they're just, the numbers are against us, that likely you are going to have an encounter with someone that you are dating with, you are dating or are friends with, like you're going to share and it's just going to happen. And you can't use that as something against your friend, against your partner, against whoever you're dating. I mean, I know I've had personal experience with it. I don't know about you, Patrick. And it's one of those things that you just have to accept it.
Well, yeah. I used to have kind of a serious problem with that. Then I kind of mellowed out. And the only time that I think I've got a problem with it now is when somebody uses it as a weapon. Like, I'm pissed off at Patrick, therefore I will go fuck Clinton. So, right. Like... Stop that. That's not cool. But like, oh yeah, we hooked up a long time ago. Okay, fine.
Right. Long time ago, before current matches happened. That's just going to be the thing and you have to laugh about it.
Yeah. I don't know. Sometimes there's a little bit of an ick factor.
Undoubtedly. Because sometimes you think, oh, you and you.
Yeah.
Really? But at that point, the past is in the past and you have to move on.
I did like that Justin was the one that just couldn't keep the secret.
Who haven't you fucked?
Hasn't fucked me. Or anybody I've been with.
What?
Nothing. Nothing.
There's me.
Oh my.
Kudos to Ben for jumping in front of that bus, though. But again, shouldn't they have like talked about this already? Because Ben knows about Michael and Brian enough that he should have told him a long time ago. This isn't the kind of secret that Ben should have been keeping. And Brian shouldn't have been keeping either. Brian, I think, can kind of get away with it because he's Brian Kinney. But Ben, I don't know. That should have come up.
I won't necessarily say that I can put that on the character. I have to take it in the context of how the show presented it, because I don't think there were enough clues to lead us as an audience that there had been some kind of history. It really feels a little bit out of nowhere.
Exactly.
Totally. It feels like it came out of nowhere. Now, if it had been something that they had set up to show why there might be some sort of antagonistic relationship between Brian and Ben, where we could read why there's a strain there, sure. But because I felt like this particular portion of their storyline kind of came out of, we need conflict to this episode.
Right.
It's hard for me to say that it landed on Brian or Ben to reveal that information to Michael, because the writers or the creators just didn't give us the clues ahead of time.
Didn't you think it would have been funny if Ben had fucked Ted?
That I would have really enjoyed, because of how Ben... Or because of how...
Oh, yeah.
That would have been interesting because of Ted's reaction to Ben's status, for one. It would have given it a deeper meaning, and I would have found that interesting because Ted had that particular scare.
I did notice that the costumers upgraded the underwear for a lot of characters. For a while, we were just getting kind of boring, label-less, generic underpants.
Mm-hmm.
This was proper underwear on Ben.
Yes.
To exist briefs. And Michael was so excited when he saw them that he was going to chew through them.
Leave your underwear on. I'm going to chew through them.
was like, wow.
Attaboy, Michael.
Now, I found it very fascinating, and maybe this was just deflection on Michael's part, that once it was revealed that Brian and Ben had slept together, that Michael used that as like a tool to get going. Like he was turned on by it. And the way I was interpreting that in that particular moment when he brings Ben home, he says he's so horned up, is that it almost felt like it was a way for him to finally sleep with Brian.
Like indirectly?
Yes.
I can kind of see that. I think there's a certain amount of turn on to that type of thing.
I mean, to me, I think there is something incredibly sexy about that, to know that a person that I could possibly be having sex with had sex with a person that
Brent Corrigan.
No, thank you. To know that there's some sort of like, again, like degree of separation. I mean, I'm a fan of that.
I did like that the social gym is back, complete with
finally
a trainer and a singlet.
It's Rainer, my new trainer. See, he's already taught you how to sit up and beg. Garth recommended him. He only trains with the best. It's definitely worth it. I can feel the difference already.
It seems that like we haven't worked out in a while, so it was nice to get some gym time in. Of course, Ted is working out because Garth had sent him there. We'll talk about Ted and Garth a little bit later in the episode, but this is the first time that we saw Ted doing like a proper workout. And
with a giant bulge right above him.
And Ted was really only there to be a little bit of a foil while Michael is noticing Brian and Fantasy Ben fucking at the squat machine.
And that's only being fed because Ted and Emmett, I think, are really like egging it on about how they would react if they found out that Brian had slept with their significant other. And it's like, of course it's going to now eat at Michael. Thanks, guys.
Yeah, again, I relate to the experience of the things that they're talking about, which is knowing the guy intimately, how he smells, what he sounds like when he's coming. But I didn't think that that was something that friends should have been doing to Michael. They shouldn't have been poking at him like that.
Exactly. Yes.
And it didn't really serve a purpose other than to try to get Michael wound up. But Michael's already wound up over this. There was quite the bedroom scene with Michael and Ben as Michael was interrogating Ben about getting fucked by Brian. Why do you think that Ben was giving details, though?
He was fucking me. And he came, right? But I hadn't. So he just kept going.
Oh, shit.
Mm-hmm. Then he came a second time. Right when I did.
It falls, I think, into the
full disclosure?
The full disclosure, sure. But also, maybe it's helping fuel the current atmosphere between mm-hmm. the two of them. Like maybe that'll get Michael going. Cause you know, sometimes there are things like when you can get into like that dirty talk, dirty detail, you know, we've seen it with Justin and Brian too, you know, that just by hearing about it gets them going.
I thought it was both funny and a little annoying that Brian just kept appearing in bed with them.
Symbolism.
It was just so nicely written, though, and directed. And I liked how Michael just could not get Brian out of his head. And that's something that I thought was really relatable when no matter what you're doing, you just can't stop thinking of somebody else, whether it's sex or whether it's like going to work or walking down the street, staring into space, whatever. So I just like the way that it was portrayed that Brian is just everywhere. Michael can't get rid of him, even the most intimate moments with hunky Professor Ben Bruckner. Do you think that Brian had an obligation to tell Michael about that? Like an obligation, like as best friends, BFFs, steam room buddies, lifelong friends. I kind of see Brian had the obligation to tell him.
Well, using the rules that he said in the beginning of the episode, he's supposed to never talk about past fucks, especially when that past fuck is a current fuck of your friend. So whatever etiquette that he had laid out in the beginning was what he was following, which I thought was sort of written for the convenience of this episode.
Well, and he never did tell Michael. Ben came out and said it. So in that scene, Brian kept his mouth shut. I just would feel like if I was Michael in that situation, I would be a little upset that my friend didn't tell me.
Sure. I mean, I definitely, previous relationship where I was told that there had been a hookup that happened between my ex and his friend. And I just sort of, I will admit, back then it irked me. But looking back on it, I'm like, why did that bug me? Because it fizzled very quickly. So, and they're friends. So why do I care?
Do you think that this might have been Brian doing one of those well-known manipulations?
No, not with this one.
Why not?
I just don't see him having any malicious intent when it comes to Ben. The way I feel like it was
Let me footnote this one. Dominguez said on...
I think it was just so...
Brian is innocent.
In this one, I really think he was. At least based in this particular episode, because we didn't have any of the hints that could have led to a buildup of this being revealed.
That's
so
true.
I have to kind of look at it only within the context of this particular episode. You know, when he made his comment at Babylon, I couldn't tell if that was just like, well, shit, I just let that slip. I shouldn't have said anything. Because now the can of worms is open.
Well, here's another thing that I'm not so sure about, where Brian shows up at Michael's comic store and starts putting the moves on him. He puts the close sign out. He locks the door. He starts feeling up Michael. Do you think that Brian was really going to fuck him right then and there? Or do you think that that was just being done to prove a point?
I will say that this moment, because I literally cannot give a yes or no answer to that question. And I thought that was actually a very complex way to present what was going on. Because I felt like that encounter in the store with Brian making such bold moves on Michael, like it was no longer where we see in the past where like they sort of have a hug that lingers too long or a kiss that's a little more intimate than usual. This was Brian full on grabbing Michael and going tongue deep with him. And Michael was definitely not joining in, as it were.
Oh, he was. No, he
there was a point where he was.
Yeah,
I am into this. But then it stops.
I think that this was a very elaborate ruse from Brian to get Michael to realize that he doesn't really want to hook up with Brian. Therefore, it shouldn't be a big deal that Brian had hooked up with Ben. It seemed a little purpose-built to teach Michael a lesson, like Brian saying, I know you're not going to go through with this, but you need to go through the experience of saying that you're not going to do it. And that would be enough for him to get over the whole thing.
It still, at some point, felt like some sort of psychological torture to Michael.
Yeah.
Because we have seen Brian put Michael through this kind of shit before. For example, his birthday party when he outs him in front of, you know, Tracy, because he's trying to push Michael away so he can have that relationship with Dr. David Cameron. Like there are so many actions that I feel very extreme. And here I'm like, this toying with Michael, who, you know, he's just not as complex a person at times that it's sometimes feels very cruel.
Brian may well have gone all the way and tossed off Michael there to get it out of the way, to just say, there, fine, we're done. Can we move on? So this scene was kind of interesting. And I like that we finally came across the scene that we're really struggling to figure out what they were doing there and why that was there.
Yes, it's nice to get a scene that is really challenging in the interpretation of it.
Well done, Michael McClane.
And not giving us a clear answer. I love that kind of stuff.
Back at Michael's apartment, Ben just shows up. I love it when people just show up in this show. They just come over.
Knocking on the door. Just walking in.
That's right. When Ben gets over to Michael's apartment, Michael's not there, obviously. Ted refers to Michael as the Beaver.
So I thought Michael might be at the store, but it was closed. He's not here?
No, haven't seen him. Hide nor hair.
Is there something wrong with the Beaver?
I get the reference, you know, Leave It to Beaver. And Emmett and Ted were like the Cleaver parents or something. But why did that come from Ted now? It was just one of those like out of left field lines that seem unexpected from a character that we know pretty well.
Was it an attempt to be clever by calling Michael the Beaver? Because like, I will freely admit, I understand the reference to a point.
Yeah,
but because I know what Leave It to Beaver is, but
well, Beaver was always kind of the happy-go-lucky, innocent, sweet, not 100% intelligent, but always meant well character. But that's a pretty obscure reference. You got to go deep on Beaver Cleaver
for this group that might have had closer experience because they're all 30 in 2002.
Leave It to Beaver was like in the 50s, late 50s.
Still probably would have been something that they would have been exposed to a little easier than...
I must admit, I like that show. I haven't seen it in years, but I enjoyed it. So I did like how Emma and Ted just kind of jumped right into the middle of this problem with glee. So we see these two characters inserting themselves into this comedic moments, I guess. It just seems weird that they just want to be right in the middle of it.
It's sort of an attempt to ground the situation in realism with humor. I feel like a lot of times what you have to do is play the opposite. When you have something that can be very hurtful or something, you have to laugh it off in some way, or to ease it before it gets too heavy, you have to give a laugh. And
sure.
I think Ted and Emmett are really great for that. Because even though they can be at times outlandish characters, they still come from such a place where they never feel like they're being mocked.
Mm-hmm.
I think Emmett is a character that could be very easily mocked, but because Peter Page plays him with such sincerity,
yeah,
that he's never the butt of the joke.
How did Ben not know any of the Brian Michael history? They've been dating for a long time. I liked Emmett and Ted's explanation of it, but it just reminded me that he should have known something of this. They've been dating for months now.
Do you think maybe that's a lesson that was learned by Michael after Dr. David Cameron?
Ah, interesting.
To maybe distance,
cool it.
Yeah, to distance it a little. Because I think there was one moment where Ben even acknowledges, like, does he always kiss you like that?
Yeah.
So, like, clearly, I think Michael has made a point to not be so...
Yeah, that's a very good
point. Here are all the feelings I have about Brian, yeah. Right off the bat.
I will dump you if he will date me. Just so you know.
Know that you are the second string.
Later on in the episode, Michael shows up at Ben's apartment. Just drop by. I called this the Michael mea culpa.
Mm.
It was nice to see Michael so put together about this when he showed up to talk to Ben about it. Because it's always really interesting to see... Something bad happened to Michael, then he goes away, collects himself, and then comes back with having fully processed all the information and can speak intelligently about it.
Look, I know you don't like to dwell on the past. You know, it's over, it's gone, let it go. But sometimes it won't let you go. Like with Brian.
What about him?
Well, I wasn't completely honest when I said it didn't matter to me that you had had sex with him. It does matter.
And why is that?
Because I've always had certain feelings for him.
What kind of feelings?
Different kinds. Friendship feelings. Love feelings.
Sexual feelings?
Not that anything ever happened or ever will. But when I found out that you and he... I just couldn't stop thinking
that I knew him in a way you don't.
And he knows you in a way that I do.
Thank you for telling me.
I had to. I love you.
Well, Chet, they sure did wait long enough to tell each other.
But Michael was such an adult in this situation, and it was, or in this moment, and it was really wonderful to see.
By the way, they are saying that they love each other after just a few months of knowing each other. That was quick.
Yeah, they're moving a little fast on that. But I think what Ben says in that moment actually really, I really identify with, and it really actually touched me in a way when he says that there's something line about including the people we loved, people that we're still in love with, doesn't mean that we can't love each other.
Yeah, it was a little deep moment.
And
nice.
I absolutely, like, when he said that, I absolutely 100% understood what he meant, that there is always going to be that part of you that may always love a person, but that doesn't have to be a wall that stops you from loving another. And I think that's actually a really beautiful sentiment. And I also thought this was a very major step for Michael in being open about what his feelings really are for Brian. Because I don't know if this was something he was always fighting against with Dr. David Cameron. Here he can say to Ben, these are the feelings I've had for Brian, and they've always kind of been there. Well, and now that he felt like he could share that, without feeling like there's going to be any type of reprisal on Ben's part, really shows that this is a partnership, or this is a relationship that has strength to it.
There was a great metaphor that was a little cliche, but I loved it. was Michael's vision of Brian walked out of the house fully clothed and just closed the door behind him.
I literally wrote in my notes. I literally wrote in my notes, "Ooh, symbolism."
Yeah, I was a little snarky about it at first, and then I was like, I don't know. I think it kind of works. It was a little expected. It's a little sophomoric, but it worked for me. I liked seeing that Brian go from like totally naked to mostly clothed, and he checks out. It was Michael closing the door on that particular thing and going all in on Ben Bruckner.
I found it a little heavy-handed. I thought the words that they were sharing with each other was doing the job for me. I do understand why it was there, because it does wrap up the visual metaphor they were using earlier. It's still a little hokey for me.
I like it when queer so it gets metaphysical. There was some nice ending dialogue with Brian and Michael on the dance floor. It was curious because Michael is talking about this guy that he did and Brian's interested. I doubt that Michael actually did that guy, but he's just not telling Brian anything about it. But didn't he learn his lesson here, though, that honesty is always going to be the best policy? So he kind of goes right back into what Brian was doing, which is keeping a secret from his best friend. So I thought it was interesting that that was tossed in. I almost wished it would have ended right with the metaphysical Brian wandering out the door.
Yeah, that's all I needed.
We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll talk about Debbie and the dumpster twink.
Be sure to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. And don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode.
Still, queer as folk.
So Debbie has definitely not moved on from the body that she found in the dumpster. I don't think anyone could really do that. It still bugs her that they still have not figured out who the victim was. So she's out to visit where he's buried, and she was given the information from the homophobic cop. There's a moment where Michael corrects Debbie's grammar.
Oh, yeah. I bumped on that, too, because Michael does not exactly employ perfect grammar.
There's something with the body. They just can't keep it laying around.
Lying around.
Is this the time to do this? I don't understand, Michael.
I like that cemetery scene, though. It was just really moving because you think about, if you put yourself into that scene, you think about that twink that ended up in the dumpster. He got dressed up to go out. He went out clubbing, was murdered, landed in the dumpster, and is now in the ground in less than a week. That's like,
this is the point that Debbie's trying to get across to everybody else. It's why she's so distraught over this. You know, she says that this was someone who was part of our community, and she even carries some guilt for not knowing his name. She only knew his order.
Spanish omelet?
Yes, Spanish omelet. It really breaks my heart to see Debbie feeling like she's a guilty party in this.
Yeah, it's totally taking a heavy toll on her. Thoughts and prayers aren't going to get her very far. When Justin and Debbie are talking in the diner after closing, and then I thought, wait, the diner closes? I thought this was like a 24-hour diner. There's a couple in the back corner that is just like making out and heavy petting the whole time.
Okay, I literally had no idea until I saw your notes that that was happening. I was actually focused on Debbie's moment.
I love that. There's some nice interactions between Horvath and Debbie.
Can I help you?
Yeah, I need to talk to somebody. But I gotta say, I was hoping it wouldn't be you.
Come in, kick back, relax.
I don't have time to relax, but I'm so glad you do. Why is there no name on his grave?
We're working on it.
Bullshit. You're not even trying.
Look, lady, I've gone through every missing persons report that even remotely matches his description. And so far, nobody's missing him.
Well, then keep looking.
Lady.
And stop calling me lady. You sound like Jerry Lewis. The name's Debbie.
Debbie.
But you can call me Mrs. Novotny.
Mrs. Novotny, don't take this the wrong way, but it's none of your business.
Oh, and don't you take this the wrong way, but it is. This kid has got a name, and I'm going to find it.
And I love how Debbie is just standing right up to Horvath. Horvath the cop, his homophobia from a few episodes ago, notwithstanding, I can see his point as a policeman about the sort of lackadaisical effort that they're putting in. because there's only so much that the police can do with limited resources. But I love that Debbie was saying, no, that's not good enough. You need to do better.
Because this kid mattered. This was someone's son. This was someone's friend. Who, you know, there has to be someone who is missing this person. And I actually love that she has her Mr. Tibbs moment. She's like, that her name is Debbie, but you can call me Mrs. Novotny.
Yeah.
I was like snapping along. And she was like really feeling her Kegan and Lacey history in this moment. Because she does go on this quest to figure out who this kid is.
We find out that Justin is now a criminal sketch artist, apparently.
Well, he's an artist, so if he's given the details, I'm sure he can fill them in.
That picture looked like a photocopy, though, by the time that flyer was made. It was nice to see Jennifer Taylor back, Sherry Miller.
Yes.
And of course, she gets to find some poppers in the refrigerator.
What's this?
What? It's just head cleaner.
I didn't think you still listened to cassettes.
Oh, honey.
Poor Jennifer was so awkward on Liberty Avenue as like the invisible woman when she's trying to hand out the flyers.
But this is one of my favorite things in this episode was seeing the way the camera did its quick pan back and forth to seeing how Debbie handles the community to how Jennifer handles the community. And that when Debbie gives her a little nudge, Jennifer just like jumps right in there.
There's one quick clip that I want to play that I thought was really funny.
Hi there. I'm Jennifer. How are you today?
Hey, Tyler. How are the warts?
They weren't on my hands.
Oh. We're trying to find out who they are.
So that's like a uniquely petrifying moment for a suburban mom to find out the warts aren't on my hand. I loved when they went into the bathhouse together.
Okay, yes.
It was like Chicks Night Out.
Let's talk about Liberty Spa, because in no way would they have just walked in there to where all the fucking was happening.
Well, I don't know. It seemed like the desk attendant was not present. He must have been cleanup room four.
or when they walked into a room where there was clearly hardcore fucking happening and they actually stopped to look at the sketch.
I myself had never been to a gay bathhouse, so I don't know what kind of bouncers or velvet rope they have at the front. Though now that I think about it, I technically have been to Steamworks in Chicago, but only because I was a little bit drunk and my friends opened the door and pushed me in and then blocked the door so I couldn't come back out. At this particular bathhouse, there's like a way in and then you kind of have to go through it to come out the other side. And since I couldn't get out the one side, I started wandering. But they have like a lobby. It's almost like a carnival.
That's the thing. Because it's such a private place,
yeah.
It didn't make sense to me that no one would have stopped them. So the logic there just didn't read with me. But it does lead to a really strong clue for Debbie.
The hunky trick.
Who says that he had hooked up with this guy and they had to stop for a second because he was having, I guess, an asthma attack.
Guy fucked him so hard that he caused an asthma attack.
Which, you know, hunky trick was like, I know I'm good.
That guy was kind of hot. I thought he was really cute. Yeah. Good casting there on the extras. Debbie's investigation leads them to the pharmacy where, of course, Vic knows the pharmacist. Phil.
Well, obviously.
I liked how it played out. Debbie is being persistent and she gets people to bend the rules for a good cause.
Even HIPAA.
Yeah.
Because I am pretty sure the pharmacist can't just show someone's prescription dead or not.
So it was useful that she brought Vic along, who is apparently a great customer at the pharmacy and knew Phil, the pharmacist. Another great scene with Horvath was Debbie schooled him about figuring out who Dumpster Boy is.
Jason Kemp.
How'd you get this?
It's called Perseverance. You should try it sometime. I even found out where he lived. Vaseline Tower.
What the hell is that?
That's where every young gay boy goes when he first moves to town.
Thanks for the lead. You could be a detective.
It's supposed to be your job.
She figured this out within a couple of days, it seemed.
Yeah.
All because she did the police work that she, and she is so spot on with this, that was his job.
She had it solved by the end of Act Two.
Good night, everybody.
I did like how she described the Vaseline Tower, where every gay boy lives when they first moved to Pittsburgh. Do you remember a few episodes ago I told you about something called the Tina Towers in Boys Town, Chicago?
Yes.
And when I heard Vaseline Tower, I was like, oh, oh. So apparently Horvath also makes house calls. He just shows up at Debbie's house. No telephone, I guess, but he knows where she lives. So he goes over there to deliver the news that he did track down Jason Kemp, found out his history, found out his troubled upbringing, going through foster homes, being out on the streets when he was 18. I thought it was great in the scene that Vic invited Horvath in for a plate of pasta. I like how Vic is always like a very generous individual. He always is nice. He always wants to make people feel comfortable. It was too bad that Horvath didn't come in for the pasta, but we get to see some compassion in Horvath here. He evolved from that homophobic dick, slang for detective.
Double meaning.
Dad joke.
Daddy joke.
Daddy actually. Joke. Watch it.
it was nice to see that Debbie's work has cracked him a little.
We did nice. Get to see a tiny little glint in Debbie's eye when Horvath was walking away. It was one of those scenes that I'd always talked about before where somebody gets dropped off, whether you're being dropped off at the Taylor house or at Debbie's house, where the person lets you in and then kind of gives a second and third look up and down the street to see who else is out there. She did that and she looked at Horvath and was like, So this is the first glint that we see that Horvath is going to be a recurring character. Okay. After the break, we'll talk about Ted and the A-Gays, my favorite story. You're listening to the Still Queer as Folk podcast.
We'll be right back. And while we're waiting for those poppers to kick in, make sure you go rate us on iTunes.
Wow. So Ted and Emmett are out at what I guess we can generously describe as an ultra lounge.
Yes, it was something very upscale because they were not at Babylon with the others.
I think in London I'd call it a vodka lounge where it's like, we have 52 vodkas on tap.
Again, listeners, I am rolling my eyes because I have thoughts about these fucking A-gays.
Ted recognized all of them, though.
He owns the biggest gay law firm in town. He represents everybody. He's a doctor. Owns that big medical group. He's the head of the Gay Businessman's Association. You see him? Co-sponsors the AIDS ride every year.
You are like a groupie at a rock concert. How do you know all these people?
I don't. I want to. They're the creme de la creme of gay Pittsburgh society.
The A-gays.
It's Garth. Garth Racine.
Close your mouth and out of the glory hole.
He's the doyen of queer cafe society. You're nothing until you've been invited to one of his soirees.
One thing I bumped on here is that Ted's outfit was atrocious. He could have at least dressed up better for the A-gays. We've seen him in some smart outfits before when he was an accountant at Wortschafter. He used to have a nice complement of like sweater vests and ties and more cleanly cut pants, like woolen pants, not plaid or not plaid. khaki.
The one thing I agreed with here was the comment he made about getting the best Bernadette Peters tickets. And I was like, I felt seen in that moment because that is truth.
There used to be something in Chicago like this. My friend at the time, I'll just say his first name. We'll call him Joe. Joe and I would go to these events. They were like an after work type of thing. And this was like maybe in the mid 2000s. And it was ostensibly like a tech event, but it was like gay techies in Chicago. Like first Wednesdays, type of thing. And we used to go and we used to just cause trouble there.
You would.
Well, we just weren't like into the whole thing of like the A-gays, like the networking. We were just there to get like bombed and point out flaws in people.
Well, and that's the thing. I also found Garth to be the most boring man on earth.
Oh, I loved Garth.
Why? I found literally nothing interesting about him. Even his voice had this real monotone, low quality. It was putting me to sleep.
I thought he was just very smooth and suave. I loved it. I loved that character. I don't think I'd hang out with him, but I thought the character was great.
He was like an anchor. He just sank to the bottom for me.
It was interesting to see Ted cast as a buffoon instead of Michael. I've often talked about how Michael is usually the buffoon and everything. But it seems like Ted should have been a little more nimble on his feet here.
I think Ted can be nimble when he's with people who are at his level, But as these people are supposed to be his level up, he's now the Michael of the area.
He was an accountant at a major Pittsburgh accountancy. So he surely had been dealing with wealthy people for a while. So he must know how to act with the, quote, higher class of people, as he called them. This was like he just came off the turnip truck.
We've seen how he tried to interact with people he tries to get with.
Yeah, but
he
fails. I feel like that's different, though.
His social cues, I feel, are not as strong as I think we want to give him credit for.
Ostensibly, Ted is a young professional, to use gay hookup slang. So I would think that a young professional who has an MBA from Wharton would be able to network with people.
Well, and look at how successful he was compared to someone like Dale Wexler.
Yeah, so that's true.
Again, I don't know if, I think maybe when he's in this a certain kind of pond, he can be the big fish.
You know, now that you mention it, I guess we are seeing a multi-season de-evolution of Ted. He starts out as the accountant. In the first few episodes, he was very straight-laced, successful accountant with his own condo. Just happened to have a 42-minute coma after taking GHB with a twink, but you can be forgiven. Could happen to anybody. Mm-hmm. To kind of getting fired, starting his own like kind of shady business, porn. So he's still like on this downward trajectory, even though he's making more and more money. So it's interesting to see this character evolve. I've often said that Ted's storyline throughout the entire series is one of my favorites because he goes through so much. Mm-hmm. He's almost like a Degrassi character.
He's got to go through every issue.
Yeah.
But you buy it and it's really wonderful.
Ted's becoming quite the regular at the Egg restaurant or Ultra Lounge, the Egg Ultra Lounge, should we call that? Mm-hmm. I like his stalking there. He brings like the whole gang. He brings Emmett, Melanie, Lindsay, who unfortunately show up as props after their unfortunate Karen Walton wedding last episode. They're just stick figures in this one. They've got handful of lines each.
Yes, they have a couple of like quips that they throw out.
They probably didn't even get their full rate for this episode. But I loved how smooth Garth Racine was when he came over to the table. He was just extraordinarily well-mannered while he was delivering his invite to Ted, which was ultimately like a seedy invite.
He was like, Ted, Garth Racine, good to see you. And I was like, ugh.
I loved it. I loved it so much.
Ted, how are you? Garth Racine, we met the other night.
Sure, of course.
Forgive me for interrupting your meal.
No, not at all. Let me introduce my friends. It's Melanie and Lindsay and Emmett.
Nice to meet you. Look, I'll only take a moment of your time. I'm having a little get-together at my place tomorrow afternoon, and I'd love it if you could drop by.
I'd love to.
Fabulous. Round three. Pleasure to meet all of you.
But yeah, so
it's quite the house, too.
Yeah, so Ted gets invited to that prissy little party that apparently is the place to be.
I would go to that party.
I would go for the free booze. I love that Ted believes that because he saw the recent production of Assassins that he's got that in his back pocket. And I agree to him to some extent that Assassins is one of Sondheim's most complex and challenging works. So good on Ted. If you don't know what Assassins is, it actually follows the various assassins who were succeeded or tried to kill our presidents. It breaks down their motivations and what led them to their eventual crimes.
Ted just gives it lip service. He just says, yeah, I saw it.
And I'm like, there is so much to discuss about it.
Yeah, you can make small talk about that for quite a while.
Yes, but that Alistair and Morley.
I love them.
Set me on fire if ever I get trapped in a corner with those kinds of people.
Psychiatrist organizes gay cruises. I liked how Garth introduced Ted as an entrepreneur who has his own website. That dated the show.
I mean, at that time, that was the truth.
That's what it was.
It was a great way to say, hi, this is Ted. He runs a porn site.
For as smooth and suave as I'm saying that Garth is here, I don't think he should have been calling Ted Teddy right away. That was too familiar.
Yes.
He should have kept up his aura of smoothness. But aha. Garth was only creeping up on Teddy to get to Rex.
That poor child, Rex.
I thought it was weird that Ted said he doesn't get involved with the personal lives of his employees. I think it would have been reasonable to tell Rex that a rich, powerful man was interested in meeting him. I just leave it up to Rex to decide if he wanted to meet him or not. How is that involving Ted?
It makes him the pimp. He is arranging the exchange that is meant to happen.
No, what I'm saying is he could leave it up to Rex and just say, Rex, I know a guy named Garth that wants to meet you. He might be into something a little more. If you want to meet him, here's his information. It worked with George Schickel.
Oh, are we really going to compare Garth to George Schickel, though?
No, but okay. I still think it should have been left up to Rex. So let's listen to a clip from Melanie real quick.
Well, come on. Those kind of people are only interested in you if you're useful to them. Right now, you're useful.
You mean being used?
Well, that's the way it is. Now you know. You want something out of them, they want something out of you. It's your call if you want to play that game.
So I like that line, and it was nice to see some wise lines from Melanie. But I think that Ted should have seen through Garth and been cool with it. I don't know. If that was me in that situation, I would know that there's no such thing as a free lunch. So
Ted wanted something. He wanted the friendship that he has with the rest of the group, but at a higher scale. He didn't think that there had to be any type of trade-off for it. But here it's, and Melanie's right, is that you clearly want something out of him. You want Garth's status.
Right.
So in order to get his status, you've got to give him something. And at that point, to give him something was to give him Rex.
Well, come on. He's not giving him Rex. I think we're led to believe that. He's introducing him. Like, I have introduced my friends to one another a number of times where somebody says, or sees me with somebody and says, oh, wow, they were really cute, or it's nice to meet them. I'm really interested in them. Can you introduce this again? Sure. That's not pimping them. I don't think Ted was taking money from Garth to meet Rex.
It still felt like
it's networking.
It still felt like there was a trade of service. Like, I'll let you into my inner circle if I feel like
if you give me an introduction to a porn star.
I felt like there was an exchange of goods happening to me.
That's how I met a porn star through you and I have a mutual friend. What else we did was meet. That's the whole thing. He didn't sell him to me or anything.
It still felt weird. Sorry. That's how I'm going to feel about it.
So I see where you're going with the story. Maybe McClellan needed to do more with it to make it seem a little more seedy. I want to buy Rex for an evening of debauchery.
But I guess to me, it's
versus saying he's quite a young man.
It still felt seedy because in comparison to say with George and Emmett knew right away that, no, I'm not here to be bought. And he stood up for himself.
True.
And
why couldn't Rex do that?
Well, and Ted also was one to say, don't you do it. Don't you fall for that kind of stuff. So Ted was never one to encourage Emmett to go with George. That was actually Debbie who did it.
I mean, come on, Matt. If you wanted to meet one of my friends, I'd introduce you.
We have been doing 30 episodes, and this is the first time you've been offering this? Come on.
I don't think you like my friends, though. Well, there's one that you like.
Anyway.
Who has a two-letter name.
Anyway.
So, Alistair and Morley.
Even their names make me want to punch them.
Those guys, I don't know why you didn't like those guys, because they were like the more, I guess, upstanding ones of the whole group.
Were they?
Yeah, they didn't do anything offensive except be bored by Ted. Ted's boring.
I was bored by them.
I'm used to that kind of vapid small talk. Ugh. So they're doing their duty and talking to Teddy at the vodka lounge. It's like they're Garth's lieutenants. They distract Garth's new, I don't know, proteges that he's inviting into the clique while Garth goes about his business. We also get to see the Twinkie Rex for the first time. There's like only like a 2 second shot of him.
He just waves.
Yeah, he looked just kind of like deer in the headlights.
Little did he know that he was the trade of the night.
That boy has the hottest ass. Website didn't do it justice.
Okay. I'm still not having like a big problem with this. Rex is technically an adult with twink looks, but he can say no. Maybe Rex is into older moneyed men.
You know what? If he is,
Emmett was,
good for him.
Yeah. There's a cliche moment at the end when Ted looks into the mirror and he doesn't like what he's become. But again, I just don't quite see that it was all that awful that it needs like the mirror reflection, woe is me, what have I become, what have I just done moment. The script didn't have enough gravity to it to make us think that Ted had sold off Rex into a night of double penetration with triple penetration with Alistair Morley and
pass
Garth.
Them around.
Yeah. And maybe this would have worked a little bit better if that was a little more in the forefront. So let's recap this episode. Timeliness. I gave this one a 3, which is my middle of the road rating. It had good stories. I liked them, but they're pretty much timeless. So this episode is just an average rating for me.
I gave it a 4. It's actually really based on the elitism, the elitist nature of that AGA group that was led by Garth Racine. I feel like there's definitely a lot of class issues that exist in the gay community. And I think this episode in particular showed how one was trying to up his game. And then we see what those AGAs have to offer, which is they will take what they want and do what they have to get it. And
well, one of them did.
Right. Well, he's a representation. I mean, he's presented as like the leader, which was very telling to me. And I feel like we have a lot of issues with that because I feel like there are those in the gay community who get left behind for those who might be a little wealthier or a little more well off. They're able to take care of themselves a little better. I think that's why we have certain log cabin Republicans.
For information accuracy, I gave this one a 3 also. Same as I did on timeliness. There just wasn't anything overtly wrong with any of the stories that puts them factually in error with modern day times.
I said 3 as well. I probably would have gone a little higher if it hadn't been for Debbie's sleuthing. Because I feel like, again, so there were certain rules that were getting bent. And I'm like, she's a waiter.
They explained away some of them, though.
Yeah,
it's like they had good excuses for
it. It kind of turned into a wash.
Relatability, I give this one a 5. I've been in the Michael Ben Brian situation too many times before, so definitely relate to that. I've also been in the Ted Garth situation where somebody was literally using me to get to somebody else, and that's a little bit different than what I was talking about before. And this the case that I'm thinking of was somebody literally only befriended me to meet my friend. This wasn't somebody that I already had a relationship with or anything like that. So I can relate to that. I've never tracked down a murder victim before, though. but I could see myself doing what Debbie did. If you turned up in a dumpster, I would do what Debbie did.
Thank you. I think that's a compliment.
5 for relatability.
I gave it a 4, mainly based on the whole idea of trying to find that that crowd to fit in that Ted was going through. You know, you're always trying to find that right group that will understand you. And so I feel like that's always kind of like the struggle. I feel like Ted at this point, he's found that group and he should be happy with the friends he has, I'd like to think. And then also the whole discussion of what it means to have former lovers with current lovers and how they have all in some way intermingled. And that's just sort of the reality of our community.
Lovers spit. So thank you. That's our verdicts on episode 12, 1 degree. Of Brian Kinney.
Next week, Michael wonders what his connection is to a celebrated drag queen who shares a past with Debbie.
And Justin decides to become a go-go dancer to pay his tuition.
That's episode 13 of season 2, and it's called It's Because I'm Gay, Right?
We are still queer as folk. Please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts and subscribe. It really means a lot to us and helps more people find our show.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Matt Dominguez.
I'm Patrick Randall. We'll see you next week. Still, Queer as Folk. It's written and performed by Patrick Randall and Matt Dominguez. Made with love in Chicago.